This week I chatted to Mike Viking, who's known as the Indiana Jones of smiles. We talk a little bit about Hygge, some of his latest books, and he is the CEO of the Happiness Institute in Copenhagen. And it was just a really great conversation that I think is much needed right now, all about how to become a little bit happier and the science and the research behind happiness trends. I hope you enjoy the episode.
I've received letters, I think, on a daily basis from people around the world saying, I've been having Hygge all my life. I just didn't know there was a word for it.
How are you, firstly? Because it is such a ridiculously strange time at the moment.
It is. I mean, never have so many things been up in the air and so many planes been on the ground. I'm doing relatively good, I think. Denmark is in a relatively good place. Of course, things are challenging here as well with COVID-19, but we are in a relatively good place, I would say, from a global point of view.
It's just such a hard one because I think everyone's sort of turning towards mindfulness and what they can do to stay mentally well in this really strange time. But we've never had to deal with anything like this. So it's really nice to be able to just speak to people, even in different countries. Like a lot of my family live in Holland. And it's just how everybody's kind of getting through it together on a global scale. It's just mental.
Right. Yeah. But I think it also helps that we know that everybody's dealing with this. If it was just us or our country that we're going through this, I think it would be tougher. I think knowing that globally we're in this together and we're facing the same challenges, I think that's actually a nice thing.
Yeah, that is a really lovely point, actually. And I think you don't get that fear of missing out as much anymore. Kind of, I feel like I can relax because no one's doing anything. Okay, so for listeners that don't know who you are, I'm going to share with them the best job title in the world, which is you are the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute. Is that right?
That's true. And I think actually I got an addition in my contract. I think my official title is CEO of the Happiness Research Institute, Chief Hygge Officer and Lord of the Dragons or something like that. I think we just added it for good fun.
Oh my goodness, that's brilliant. Oh, that's so good. I actually also read somewhere that you're the Indiana Jones of smiles.
I've heard that one too. I really like that one.
Yeah, it's great. You can put them all on your CV. Not that you need a CV. So for people that are listening, I mean, I've loved your work for quite a few years. You're one of the first podcasts I ever listened to, I think, a couple of years ago, which got me into Hygge. But I don't think I'm pronouncing it right. So before we do the rest of the interview, I'd love to know how you pronounce Hygge. Is it Hygge? Is it Hygge? Is it Hygge? What is it?
The second one, it's Hygge, yes. I've heard a lot of different interpretations. I've heard the ones you mentioned there. I've heard Hygge, which I think is also a good one. So perhaps we should all switch to that. I've heard Ick is popular in France. So whatever goes.
Whatever goes, yeah. And I think, Hygge is the thing that really got me interested in this whole theme of happiness and kind of the science behind it. And I think that's why I really love a lot of your books, because there's real science and research behind some of the stuff that you're saying. So to start off with, you're obviously based in Copenhagen.
Yes.
And Denmark is regularly on the happiest places to live list, isn't it? Why do you think that actually is?
I think there's a lot of factors. What we often hear from people coming from London or New York and settling into Denmark is the fact that we have a very different work-life balance compared to those places. People experience suddenly you are able to have dinner on a daily basis with your family instead of being stuck in the office, and it is possible to have an interesting career and also having enough time to spend with family and friends. Of course, it also has to do with the sort of general welfare state policies. I think for Denmark and the Nordic countries, it goes that all those countries are really good at reducing causes for unhappiness. So there's access to healthcare, there's free university education. You even get a government grant if you want to go to university. Of course, there's social security and relatively good pension schemes. And access to those pillars that drive quality of life, of course, reduces why people have reasons to be unhappy. Yeah. So you could say that, you know, the Nordic countries, you can say either they're the happiest countries in the world, or you could turn it around and say perhaps they are the least unhappy countries, because a lot of these rankings are based on averages. So in Denmark, we reduce misery, that brings up the average, and that's why we often come out on top. But of course, there's a lot of factors behind it.
Yeah, that's so true. And if you're listening and you want to learn more about that, that I'll share all the books that Mike's written so that you can kind of have a look into that. But I find it really fascinating that the state is what supports that happiness and well-being, because I think some people get trapped in this, you know, circle of working and working themselves into the ground and not really prioritizing the smaller things in life. So I really love that then they don't feel like they're doing something wrong for, you know, enjoying life and spending time with their family. Yeah. So I think that's wonderful.
But of course, there's a lot of factors. And yes, where we live, you know, influences our quality of life and well-being. You know, the Nordic countries do well, Switzerland, Austria, the Netherlands, you mentioned you have family there. They often do well in happiness rankings as well. The least happy countries are, you know, unsurprisingly, countries like Syria, Afghanistan, and countries like that. But it's not the only thing that matters. We can also see genetics matter. We can see how old we are matters. So there are some things we cannot control or have little control over. But there's also things we can control. We can influence our mood, doing something active, doing something together with other people, seeking out meaningful activities. That also seems to have a positive impact on well-being. So I think we need to look at happiness the same way we look at health. You know, there's something that's out of our hands when it comes to our longevity and our health. Also the country we live in impact our health, you know, the air pollution or the quality of the healthcare, but also the choices you make on a daily basis, your diet, your exercise regime, alcohol, smoking, and so on. So things you can control and things you can't control. And I think the same goes for happiness.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I think I love that you've been able to put all of this kind of in a really palatable way for people that don't really understand how they can kind of, you know, make more of their life and build their own happiness. So I'd love to dive into my favorite book of yours, which is The Little Book of Hygge. And I wondered if you could kind of just give listeners an idea of what hygge actually means so they can kind of get to grips with it. In a nutshell.
So it's 288 pages, but
in
30 seconds, yeah. No, that's fine. I mean, it's been called a lot of things. I think the best short definition of hygge is the art of creating a nice atmosphere. So it's a perfect night in, it's spending slow downtime with the people we love, basically. And of course, that happens everywhere, also outside Denmark. It's just that Danes have a word that describes that situation and that activity. And we talk about it a lot. So I've received letters, I think, on a daily basis from people around the world saying, I've been having hygge all my life. I just didn't know there was a word for it.
Yeah.
But I think also that there is a pleasure in the laziness that hygge is. I remember one French mother wrote me that earlier she would have had an afternoon together with her two kids and had some tea and some biscuits and just been on the sofa with some blankets. And earlier she would have called that a lazy afternoon. Now she calls it a hyggelig afternoon. And I think it's nice that we, with a word, remove the guilt from what should be a nice afternoon activity with your kids.
That's such a good point. It's removing that guilt, isn't it? Because I would say it's coziness. It's being cozy with family and not feeling like you always have to be out and about. And it's really interesting because I know you have another book, which is The Key to Happiness. And I've lived in London for many years and we've just moved to the outskirts of London. And there was a quote in there where you said that It was around a piece of research about potentially where you live. And you said something around it is noticeable that people that live in the countryside are often happier than those that are in the big cities. But those people that are in big cities are often more ambitious. So the right. downside of being ambitious is you're chronically dissatisfied
with the status quo. Yes.
Yeah. And that, you know, that really hit the nail on the head for me, because I kind of thought, you know, why sometimes am I not satisfied? And I'm sure many people have that kind of question. But then to be able to just be given a word that describes what that cozy feeling of takes that guilt away and makes you kind of step back and go, it's fine to be ambitious, but I also want to be happy in the now, you know?
Yeah. I think, yeah, I think it shows the complexity and the challenges of being human with the drivers yeah. that we have built in. You know, we have ambition. And that what you know that is what have brought the human race forward. But it's also a shame that there is no accomplishment that we can achieve that's going to make us happy for or after. You know, there's always going to be a new goal set. There's always going to be something else that we want, and that's something in happiness research that is called the hedonic treadmill. But I think it's actually nice to be aware of that mechanism, because then you know, okay, it's great to have this goal, and if I achieve it, that's great, and I'm going to be happy for a while, and then I'm going to set a new goal. So understanding that mechanism beforehand, I think it's actually, to me, it's been beneficial at least.
Right, can you hear me again? Perfect. One sec, it's just doing some health checks. Yeah, I'm always very conscious that I could re-record my voice, but I don't want to lose yours. So,
well, if you are to imitate me, then you have to do it. You have to struggle with V's and W's in a rapid succession.
Okay.
If you have to say something like the Viking Warrior Review, that's where you often will trip.
Sting. Okay, good to know. So if you do cut out, I will start impersonating you. Yeah. I'm sure I could be the Indiana Jones of smiles. So in terms of the last few months that have been going on, I've heard this term Corona Hygge recently. What is going on there? Are people kind of just trying to adapt this whole coziness thing into the pandemic?
I think so. I've seen that as well. And I've seen a rise in interview requests around Hygge in the past 6 months. And I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of us have been in lockdown and forced indoors. And as we talked about earlier, Hygge has been called the perfect night in. So I think it's just people saying, okay, we're locked down, we got to stay inside. So let's bring out the books and the blankets and the things to make life more hyggely.
Yeah.
So I think it's a global strategy that mimics what Danes do in the winter part of the year, right? So Denmark in the winter time, it's cold, it's dark, it's wet. So for us Danes, I think Hygge has been a survival strategy. It, you know, Hygge happens throughout the year, it happens in the summer, but I think we need it for winter. And I think that's what the world has also embraced now, that okay, we are forced indoors, so let's make the best of it. You know, let's spend 3 hours cooking a slow roast dinner and bring out some candles and some board games and some books, and let's camp here for the next few months. I think that's what's been going on.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, to be honest. It's been a horrendous few months, but it has really forced everyone to just put the brakes on and go, right, you know, what am I doing? What are the things that I can enjoy at home and my family? So, yeah, I mean, I guess it is good, and it kind of raises awareness of people needing to take that time out, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'd love to ask you a question that I'm sure you've been asked before, but is there a piece of research or something you found out that's really surprised you about happiness?
Yes, I think, I mean, now I've worked with it for almost a decade. And I think every year there is surprises and there is like new findings coming out that are super interesting. I think in the past couple of years, some of the most interesting findings have been a nuance to the relationship we see between money and happiness. So usually we see money matters, right? So we can see on average people that have larger incomes are also on average more satisfied with life. But the relationship here is, you know, being without money is a cause of unhappiness. Because if you can't put food on the table, if you don't have a roof over your head, of course, that is a cause of stress and worry and concern and misery and unhappiness. But once you get to a certain level of income, additional 100 euros per month is not going to impact how you feel. So that's typically the picture we see. But the nuance I heard a couple of years ago was a study that had looked at siblings over time and could see, they wanted to do siblings because there you can sort of remove the parental effect on people. So that's why it's interesting to look at siblings. And what they saw, and we have to fact check this because I can't remember the details exactly, but I think they measured the siblings when they were 16 and 19 and in their early 30s. And what they saw was the happier sibling was also at 16 or 19 was also the sibling that went on to make more money later in life in their early 30s. So maybe, so that's turning it on its head, the whole relationship between money and happiness. Maybe maybe both effects exists, but maybe we see richer people are happier because happier people go on to make more money. Every year there's new findings coming out that is diving deeper into these findings, and I think it's super exciting to be part of an academic community that is still sort of exploring dark spots on our map. Mm-hmm. That was just on the top of my head one of the latest, I think, most interesting, also the most complicated findings, but yeah, every year there's something new.
I'm going to go and ask my brothers now how much they earn. No, I won't do that. You've written another book, which is The Art of Making Memories. And would you like to tell listeners a little bit about that and kind of what was the inspiration behind writing that book?
Sure. So the inspiration was, I think, twofold. So there was a sort of professional motivation, and that is we can see people who are able to form a positive narrative about their lives are also happier overall. One of the things people struggle with when they are dealing with depression is, of course, not only are they unhappy right now, but they actually struggle remembering any time, some of them struggle to remember any time in the past they were happy at all. Could we do something to help people retrieve happy memories? And could we do something to create more happy moments and give ourselves better odds at holding on to those happy moments? That was the sort of professional motivation. And then there was a personal motivation because a couple of years ago, I turned 40. And from a statistical point of view, that means that I have lived half my life because men on average currently in Denmark lived until we are 80. So I thought, okay, looking back on the first half, what were my happiest moments and which were my happiest memories and how can I use that knowledge going forward and create happy future memories in the next 40 years to come. So that was sort of the personal motivation for it. And super interesting and fun book to write. Because I could use a lot of my, of course, own personal memories, and I have developed such a huge respect for our memory. I mean, there is so much stuck in there, and there's also so much we can do to retrieve happy memories or to make sure that the moments we want to remember, we can actually remember them. And I think that's perhaps the biggest takeaway from the book or the research or writing the book, is that we do have an influence over what we and our family and friends remember in the future. So I think seeing ourselves as a memory architect and influencing people's memories, I think is a superpower to have. And yeah, we do have that.
I really love that, because it's so true. When you get together with old friends or family, you end up reminiscing about moments that you've had together, and it really sparks like an exciting night where you just have all these memories.
Right.
But did you have any memories that you were like, that is far too embarrassing? That is, we can't put any of these in the book.
I enjoy sharing my embarrassing moments. I put plenty of embarrassing moments in there. Nothing was spared. I think one of my most embarrassing moments were on national TV in the UK. I think you have something called This Morning Show.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah. With Holly and Phil.
Right, Holly and Phil. That's right. And I think it was when I did. It was when I did. I did an interview for my second book around Lücke, and you know, it's live. I think they have maybe 4 million viewers, almost as many viewers as I have countrymen in Denmark. And Phil, that's the sort of the male host with the, yeah, gray hair or white hair. Yeah.
You like with the hair, yeah. With the hair. It's gray.
Right, okay. Executive blonde, I like to call it. So he's saying, so earlier you've written about Hygge, now you've written about Lücke, what are you going to write about next? And his Danish was really good, you know, pronouncing Hygge and Lücke spot on. And I thought maybe he had seen one of the Danish TV dramas that's been shown in the UK. I know you've seen, you know, this, you know, The Bridge and The Killing and the sort of political drama, you pronounce it Borgen. I thought maybe he'd seen one of those. And we pronounce Borgen differently. So you know, he says Hygge and Lücke, and I say, hey, well done on pronouncing Danish. You must have been watching a lot of Danish porn, which is how we pronounce it. But he heard, you must have been watching a lot of Danish porn. So he starts to laugh, and the other hosts, they start to laugh. I have no idea what's going on. It's German exam all over again. And I think that was the end of the interview. No, Holly said, what did he say? And then Phil says, I'm afraid to ask. And that was the end of the interview.
And then you're off air and you're like, what happened?
Yeah. So yeah. But the point is, when there's something that's emotional, like embarrassing situations are, we are more likely to remember them. So yeah.
Oh, it's so interesting, isn't it? You wouldn't think something as small as, you know, just memories can be so powerful. So that's why I really love kind of the concept of that book. So there's one other thing you said that you've been up to, which is you've been building the Happiness Museum in Copenhagen. Yes. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yes. So we've been planning and talking about that for the past 2 or 3 years, I think. And the motivation were several things. So first of all, we get a lot of letters and mails from people who wants to come by and see the Happiness Research Institute. And I think, you know, people imagine, you know, all we do all day is play with puppies and eat ice cream. And then they come and they're quite disappointed because we're 10 people sitting in front of computers looking at numbers. So we thought, why don't we create a place where people can come and, you know, learn about what we do and get some answers to the questions that we try to solve. And the second thing is, you know, we're a think tank. We try to communicate findings from the academic community to the wider public. Mm-hmm. And I write books, we do reports, we do online courses, we do presentations, we do interviews, of course. But a museum was just another way to communicate what we know. So we found a place in central Copenhagen and tried to give our audience sort of a 360 tour around happiness. So There is the history of happiness. There is geography of happiness, the science of happiness, happiness around the world, and hope that, you know, people will leave the museum a little wiser and a little happier, but also a little more motivated to make the world a better place. It's a small museum, but we like to say it's a small museum about the big things in life.
Yeah.
And we announced that we would open early March. We announced that we would open in May, and then the following week there was a press conference by the Prime Minister.
I don't know what you're talking about. What?
And then we were eventually able to open in mid-July. And we know it's not the best time to open a museum, but we thought, okay, the world does need a little bit more happiness these days. So we opened, and then we are, like everybody else, waiting for a vaccine.
But that's what I think, like you just said, you said it's not the best time, but that probably means it is the best time. I think people need this type of thing at the moment. So it's so good that you opened. If you could open one in London at some point, I'd love that. But I'm sure I'll get over there at some point. But I did want to ask you a question that I ask all of my guests, and that is, I know there's so much research that you do and there's so many things that can kind of improve your happiness. But is there one thing that you do every day that just makes a huge difference to you?
Yeah, there is, I think, something I do every day. And I think it falls under the hat of what is often articulated in Denmark as the ABC for mental health. So the ABC is act, belong, commit. And the sort of general advice that is given often in Denmark is doing something active, doing something together with other people, and doing something meaningful. And of course, I mean, finding things that build all those elements into one is great. If we can, over the summer, you know, my girlfriend and I, we went mushroom hunting. I would classify that as something meaningful and active, and of course together with other people. But on a daily basis, I think the closest that the thing that comes closest is going for an evening walk, either before or after dinner. My girlfriend and I like to go for a walk about 30 minutes, 45 minutes, just around the neighborhood, and that gives us a bit of activity. It's a great way to spend some time together or just relax. So we do that on a daily basis and I think it's definitely good for my mood.
Yeah, that's lovely. And do you know what? So many people, when they ask that question, feel like they have to come up with a really, really exciting answer. I'm not saying yours isn't. It's really exciting, but it's honest. You know, a walk is something that is just taken for